now. Detonate the reality bomb!
I will build a great, great wall.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The truth is out there.
The military-industrial complex.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know.
Change has come to America.
Catapult of propaganda.
From a secure location on top of the ridge in the heart of the beautiful Missouri Ozarks, this is a view from the bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
Below your feet lies a world unseen. And hopefully, prayerfully, if we're blessed, we won't see what's going to come out of it at some point. Watch this.
And the Lord said unto Satan, Whence comest thou? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, From going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it. Job 1:7.
The world consists of vast cultures with stories that constantly connect their gods with the inner earth. And not just their gods, but reptilian races of hybrid entities. We're talking superhumans, strange animal creatures, or what the Book of Giants refers to as monsters. When you're dealing with the areas around the world where so much myth, legend, oral tradition, and belief, contemporary belief, there's always almost an embracing of the underworld.
The earth is actually dynamic. By that, what I mean is that, you know, we all go to work every day, we get in our car, we are driving over a shell under which, according to the Bible, there is supernaturalism, there are entities, there are creatures, there are beings.
If you were going to hide something and keep something secret, there's two places to do it. One is in the deep, deep oceans. The second place is a labyrinth, a network of tunnels and areas which go deep underneath the earth.
There was truth to this idea that this race called the Vril-Ya had been existing under the earth since the days of the Great Flood in the antediluvian world. In fact, the belief of the Vril-Ya and of the power of Vril was actually so prominent among German occultists that it gave birth to a secret society, one of the most notorious secret society involving the Nazi regime, called the Vril Society.
The Nazi expedition to Shambhala originally started in Greenland with the Edda. The Edda were ancient Nordic writings describing a hollow earth. They went there to see if they could find further details or information. This was the top of their agenda. They had to find this opening. And the next thing you know, they had the Neuschwabenland expedition to the Queen Maudland area of the Antarctic. It's what drove them. It was a religious belief that drove them to cordon this area off and claim it for their own.
When I read Admiral Byrd's description of things that he saw and how it felt going into this abyss type of opening. But it also was a long time ago, and we've learned a lot about quantum physics since then. We've learned a lot about how these types of things would work. And there are too many descriptions in there of things that he saw that line up with current quantum physics understanding.
The underworld of our people, very similar to the Cherokee stories, the Creek stories, the Maya Incan stories of underwater panther and these underworlds where there is completely different civilizations that lived under there.
We know in the Bible that the watchers, the angels who kept not their first estate, according to Peter, are kept in chains in Tartarus until the judgment, kept in darkness until the judgment. Tartarus, in Greek mythology, is as far below Hades. It's not Hades. It's as far below Hades as the earth is below heaven. That's where the watchers, according to Peter, have been confined.
we're finding out is that the fallen angels and demonic entities have been molding the views. They've been molding the cultures, and hyper-intentionally, they've been molding the religions of the world. They've been literally priming the world for the greatest deception of all time. And we are fast approaching that time right now, according to the Bible.
Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. We thank you for listening at VFTB.net or watching if you're checking out the YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. That was a trailer for the forthcoming film due in August, August 1, from the guest this week, our guest, the writer, producer, director of The Hollow Earth Chronicles, Episode 1, The Dark Chambers. We welcome from Fourth Watch Films, Justin Fall. Justin, welcome.
Eric, thanks for having me.
We got you here at the Skywatch TV studios here in the Ozarks for, I think it's about the 17th interview in the last 2 days, I think. So
it's been action-packed. It's
yeah,
been good.
Yeah, even over dinner last night, you were still getting grilled. So it was
I learned something last night, Derek, and this is one of those moments where you ruin something special that I own. I own this doctrine. I own this theology, and it's so perfect. And then you step in, and I make a joke about my doctrine about I'm having fried Dagon.
Right, right.
Because I mean,
you were having the catfish.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently, I wasn't obeying Torah by eating catfish. I've been told recently that can't have catfish. But anyway, I'm eating fried catfish, fried Dagon, and you say, well, actually –
yeah.
And Derek says, actually, you perk up. Okay, what is it? And apparently Dagon was not a fish god.
No.
Thank you, Derek Gilbert.
Not in any not in any way, shape, or form, sadly. In fact, I was pulling this up while we were working in the studio there today. I was pulling up the iconography of Dagon, but we'll do that in another program. The Hollow Earth Chronicles. This is something that I think a lot of people looking at it would say is really fringe. In fact, when you first came out to interview Tom and then Josh and then were gracious enough to put me on camera, put Sharon on camera to ask, you know, us questions about what we might know about the Hollow Earth, which in my mind I thought was practically nothing, and then found out, oh, wait a second now, there's actually something to this, because when you read the Bible carefully, what lies beneath appears in verse 2 of the Bible, Genesis 1:2. The Spirit of the Lord hovered over the face of the waters, over the face over the deep. I'm going to have to look it up now to make sure I'm not mangling scripture, which
you're
is a bad thing to do.
You're putting me on the spot because now I'm supposed to either nod or not nod.
No.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, of course, people listening are just totally thinking, well, you're just sitting there patiently while Derek is pontificating. The people watching on YouTube actually know better. And if I'd been prepared for this better, I would have already had this pulled up. The earth was without form and void, or as some say, scholars say, the earth was made formless and void, which indicates there was something pre-existing.
Became.
Yes, the earth became formless and void. And darkness was over the face of the deep. Now, the word translated deep there is the Hebrew word tahom, which is a cognate for an Akkadian word temtum, which is the Akkadian version of the Sumerian word Tiamat. Tiamat was the primordial chaos dragon, chaos monster, that the Hebrews knew as Leviathan. Now, we know from elsewhere in the Bible that God, Yahweh, defeated Leviathan, break Leviathan in pieces. Of course, the ancient world, their God, decided to, the fallen basically tried to credit their gods for what Yahweh did, Marduk or Enlil or Baal defeated, you know, the various monsters. But the point being, though.
Typical paganism.
Exactly, yeah. Which is why the subtitle of my book is Satan's Psyops from Eden to Armageddon, because the Psyops began very early on, obviously. The point is that something was down there in the abyss, in the deep, Tehom, which is the abyss, before God even began creating. Before God even said, let there be light. And now we fast forward, you know, however many thousands of years we are, and discover that this belief that there is something in the earth below has been a driving force in some of the most important events of the last century or more. So with that as a place to begin, what was it that drove you to begin the research that culminated in the Hollow Earth Chronicles?
one of the taglines, it's probably going to be a viral tagline that people are going to just keep repeating about this film, is in Job, where Satan goes before the Lord, and the idea is God says, "Whence comest thou?" That's the King James Version. Mm-hmm. The good old English, "Where have you come from?" That's the gist of it. "Where have you been?" And Satan comes back and he says, "I've been going to and fro, back and forth, up and down
in the earth."
The earth. Wow. And so we come to a point as Bible researchers where we have to say, okay, I'm not really concerned how he's doing it, right? I mean, doesn't really concern me how he's doing it, but what type of demonic complex mm-hmm. is located inside the earth that requires Satan's direct attention? That's the question at hand. Mm-hmm. And so when we have that question in our mind as part of our journey into this epic area of research, we have that idea that there's a demonic complex there. Satan isn't just sending out his little minions. He's going there directly for some purpose. Something needs him to be there, at least on a schedule. So based on that, we say, okay, what do the pagan religions believe? What have the gods of old been teaching mankind for thousands of years about the inner earth? And how come there's always connections with the gods of old and the monsters and the hybrids? There's always connections, Derek, with all of these things and the inner earth. Mm. That right there tells us this is interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I've said about other, you know, beliefs that aren't necessarily true. Like, for example, one of the things that I stumbled onto in researching my book was the fact that ancient Amorite kings, specifically the kings of Ugarit, which was a society on the coast of Syria or Lebanon, now Syria today, on the Mediterranean coast, believed that their kings were descended from the Titans, the Watchers. They called them the Council of the Detano. They held a necromancy ritual to crown the new king. Were they really descended from the Watchers? Probably not, because the descendants of the Watchers were mostly killed in the flood, although there were some Nephilim after whenever the sons of God went into the daughters of men. So, you know, maybe not. The point is they believed it, and that's how they were acting. You know, they were doing things that God told the Israelites not to do, and it was for the things that the Amorites were doing that they got pushed out of Canaan, necromancy just being one of them.
Right.
So, the point is that what you believe determines how you behave, and what you believe determines whether or not you get saved. So if you are believing that something is under the earth that is going to come out and usher in a golden age, for example, instead of believing in Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior, well, okay, doesn't matter if there's really something under the ground or not. If you believe it, that's, you know, what God's going to use to determine your ultimate destiny, your ultimate destination, rather.
That's the center of their faith.
Exactly. However, there is some evidence to suggest that something is going on down there, and that's the thing that I found fascinating about this. And when you marry that with the belief, going back to Genesis 1, verse 2, or the evidence that something, you know, going back to the very beginning of creation, that something was down there in the abyss, that in verse 2, the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Why? To keep something in there? Yeah, what's down there? Well, what did you find in your research? What do these other pagan beliefs say is down there?
Well, it's interesting that we're talking about the deep, because you can't get into the Hollow Earth research and just keep this idea of subterranean below the surface of the crust. Mm-hmm. You have to go further than that, because there is this wide connection with the oceans of the world.
Mm-hmm.
We're dealing with these giant bodies of water, and you go into the water, and once you're into the water, you have underwater caves.
Right.
You make it in through that cave, and then you can come up, and you're now on dry land inside the earth. So parts of these cavernous systems, or what we would call subterranean realms, some of them are accessed through water. Okay. This is interesting, because when you get into the serpent people, or what you and I would call the reptilians, what the Hindus would call the Naga had an affinity with water. Water is almost always showing up in the lore surrounding the serpent people. Sometimes they would have to enter into water to get to their domain. or their domain entrance would be close to a body of water. Mm-hmm. In witchcraft, there's ideas of water spirits. There are spirits connected with water, even with the goddess worship or the worship of the horned god in Wicca. You're dealing with a connection with water and rituals. Mm-hmm. So water does play a role in all of this. Joseph Riverwind tells some amazing stories. One in particular family story in the film he brings up about something coming up from the water. You've got entities coming up from the water. You've got flying machines coming up from the water. Mm-hmm. So there is a connection with the deep, you know, what we would call the ocean. Some would say the abyss. Now, my opinion of the abyss is slightly different than just the ocean, obviously.
Yeah.
But the word gets thrown around quite a bit. But in the Hollow Earth research, you're going to see you're dealing with subterranean, and you're also dealing with beneath the surface of the water. Mm-hmm.
It's a little more dark than what's the little lobster character in the Littlest Mermaid or whatever? Under the sea. No, yeah.
Sebastian.
Sebastian, right. Under the sea. Things coming out of the water. Again, this goes back to ancient Sumer, which was the first, scholars agree, is the first civilization on humanity. It's kind of funny because you've got the archaeologists who are convinced that mankind originated in Africa and then spread from there. But, you know, historians and anthropologists looking at where civilization first arose in a major way, it appeared fully formed out of nowhere in ancient Sumer. Mm-hmm. Which has led some to speculate that the original Edenic civilization or post-Edenic civilization may have been underneath what is now the Persian Gulf. So anyway, the point is that Sumerians believed, and then the later Babylonians believed, that the Watchers, what they called the Apkallu, came from the Apsu, the abyss, which was located at the city of Eridu in what is now southeastern Iraq. There's an Italian-Iraqi team working there now. For the first time since like 1949, they're out there digging since early 2015. Haven't seen any reports yet, but that's interesting that they're back there digging at this place. The largest and oldest ziggurat in Mesopotamia is there, and that was the Temple of Enki, the Eapsu, the House of the Abyss. And that was where he sent forth these watchers, the Apkallu, from the abyss to bring the gift of civilization to mankind. And one of those, and this was the Dagon creature, is a fish man hybrid. And that was the picture Alexander Hislop used in his book, The Two Babylons, to say, oh, this is what the priest of Dagon looks like. Well, no, sorry, Alexander. It wasn't. But the later Babylonian historian, Barassus, wrote of a character called Oannes, who was a hybrid fishman creature and brought forth wisdom from the sea, came out of the sea. And I forget if it was every day and they had to go back every night or came out every night and had to go back in the day, whatever, but was able to come out and impart wisdom and knowledge to the early Sumerians and the Babylonians, who made a point of attributing their greatness to the knowledge that had been preserved, the pre-flood knowledge that had been preserved and entrusted to them, which I think is why God told the Apostle John that Mystery Babylon was the name of the one world end times religion, mm-hmm. that pre-flood knowledge. So again, you've got stuff that these ancient pagans believed that tracks with what we see in the biblical condemnation of Babylon. But then it manifests in some really weird ways, and again, unexpected ways, because when I think most average Christians, people sitting in the pews, hear this stuff, it's like, oh, this is nuts. Nobody believes this. Yeah, some very powerful people did. Who, for example, the last 150 years or so would have been influenced by this, and how did it affect their worldview?
Well, let's just talk about how many people are inspired by these book. Well, the book written by Jules Verne. You've got Journey to the Center of the Earth.
20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. But you've got the movies that were inspired by Journey, and mm-hmm. you've got modern day renditions. You've got a mystical island where you have to enter into a cyclone of a tornado to breach a dimension to land on this perfect island where there's giant animals, giant creatures, supernaturalism. Mm-hmm.
And Doug McClure.
Right. I mean, all, yeah, yeah. No, but you've got all these elements of occultism
mm-hmm.
in these movies. Now, not that it's like some dangerous movie for kids, because I'm not saying that. It's very harmless on the surface. But researchers like ourselves, we're going to watch these movies and we're going to say, okay, this is very interesting. How did we go from Brendan Fraser looking at a dinosaur inside the earth to The Rock? You know, mm-hmm. Well, I think he's earned it. Let's just call him Dwayne Johnson. He's
right,
earned
sure.
it.
Yeah, yeah.
I love him. Okay. Anyway, now that my closet, okay. but no, so he, you go from this crazy inner earth idea to a secret island crossing through a dimensional doorway, all branching off of the writings of Jules Verne. Now, whether there's truth or not to the idea that Jules Verne actually encrypted some type of message of truth in his books, I don't know if that was speculation based on the movies or not. But what I find interesting is how one man writes these stories and the world picks it up and loves it, because there's something inside of us that likes adventure. And so when we think there's possibly truth to this, we get excited. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm here to say, in this film, we're going to prove to you that there is an inner earth, that there are realms inside the earth, both physical and spiritual, and cultures of the world have held to these beliefs for thousands of years. And even further than that, most of these underground cities, or what we would call subterranean realms, go back to the days before the flood, where there were inhabitants mm-hmm. of supernatural entities and even gods of old. And even in the Native American Indian stories, we find out that the gods of old from certain tribes, they were pushed up to the surface. This is an interesting aspect, and I think we may have talked about this in one of the TV slots, but we have stories of these gods coming up and telling the Navajo, mm-hmm. not, well, that's just one tribe right there.
Right, right.
But dealing with the Navajo specifically, Navajo were told their gods come up and they teach the Navajo, they teach them how to do certain things.
Mm-hmm.
That, almost like the Mez, what you talk about the Mez in your book, you know, the ways of living and the knowledge.
Gifts
of
civilization, right, yeah.
That's brought from these supernatural entities.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is the old ancient ones who have supernatural abilities, they come to the surface, but this is the thing, Derek, they come to the surface because of a great flood which came from the
below,
core,
yeah, yeah.
Or however they want to explain it, right, from below, they're rushed out. Now, you can't kill the ancient ones, technically speaking, until it's their time before the Lord, because they're supernatural entities. So they're forced up to the surface of the earth from this great flood, because the Bible says the waters came from above and below.
Right.
And so the cavern systems, the subterranean worlds, they got pushed up. While they're up, they started teaching mankind all these things, but once the flood waters went back down, they went back down into their great caverns.
Hmm.
So even these pagan stories, they line up with the biblical flood account. We see the biblical flood account showing up everywhere. You can't deny mm-hmm. it. Even if someone's listening right now and they don't believe in the Bible, every culture of the world practically has a story of the flood.
Right, right.
Sumerian, and technology before the flood.
Right. Yeah, Sumerian King List mentions, you know, and then the flood swept over. So they've got a differentiation in the Apkallu. There were seven before the flood and four after, and the seven before were all divine. The four after were just semi-divine, but also partly human. So, yeah, it goes all the way back to the beginning of the invention of writing, which, again, took place at Sumer, where civilization just sort of, you know, instant civilization. Hey, cities!
I'm not interviewing you here, but this is an interesting thing. Your research into the Sumerian history, which it's religious, no doubt about it. This is strongly mm-hmm. Supernatural religion
yeah.
at its finest, dealing right. with paganism. When you get into the Sumerian, you find some very interesting things that generally are involving extraterrestrial type entities.
From a modern perspective, the Sumerians never viewed them as coming from anywhere other than, you know, the sky maybe, but they didn't have any concept of other worlds. Not that I found any evidence of. The only purveyors of that information really began with Eric von Daniken, picked up by Zechariah Sitchin, who, as Mike Heiser said, either couldn't actually read Sumerian or he did and he was just lying about what the tablets say, because actual Sumerian scholars, guys who can read Sumerian, say that none of those tablets say anything like what Sitchin and his followers claim that they say. It's only from a modern perspective that those things look like extraterrestrials, and I think that's part of the enemy psyop that has been foisted on us.
In those days, they didn't have TV shows that were promoting aliens from outer space. They didn't have these ideas. They didn't have Independence Day coming out in theaters.
Well, and the iconography that they used, and I guess the most well-known example is Ezekiel chapter 1, Ezekiel's wheel. You know, the wheel within a wheel, and you know, the wheels at eyes and flames and, you know, whatever. That was iconography of the royal throne that was known and had been known throughout the entire ancient Near East for hundreds and hundreds of years by the time Ezekiel came around in the, what was he, 6th century BC. He was during the time of Nebuchadnezzar. So, yeah, in the 500s BC. The thrones of the kings, the earthly kings, were modeled on the descriptions that we see of the throne of God in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, Moses didn't write down the words of the Bible, and there are scholars who say that Moses didn't write it down at all, that a lot of this stuff was written down after the exile in Babylon. Whatever. You know, don't care. The point is that for – you can go back and look at the iconography that has been found in Egypt, in the ancient kingdom of Syria, the ancient king Assyria, Babylon. You always find these throne guardians, what we would call cherubim or seraphim. You'd find little wheels on the legs of the chairs. You find the legs of the thrones, you know, looking like animal legs. Basically, the earthly king said, "I want a throne that looks like the throne of a god, or a throne worthy of a god." And it was what Ezekiel was describing is something that anybody familiar with the ancient Near Eastern world would have said, "Oh yeah, that's a throne of a king."
Right.
Of course, it's the king that we're seeing. You know, that's his throne that we're seeing here. But from a modern 20th or 21st century perspective, we're thinking, "Oh well, they just didn't recognize a spaceship when they saw one." No, it's the other way around.
Exactly.
We just don't recognize an ancient royal throne when we see one.
That's right.
So
but it's kind of like it's almost a handicap that we have,
right,
living in this situation, because back then it wasn't like, "Oh, that's a UFO." You know, it wasn't unidentified. Matter of fact, it was super identified.
It was identified. Yeah, you're right.
It was common.
It was not an unidentified object.
And so, you know, you call something a UFO today and people look at you like you're crazy. And it's like, look, it's just unidentified.
Yeah.
Well, somebody identified it a long time ago, but we don't know what it is.
Right.
Specifically.
Right.
So we're going to call it a UFO. And now there's a conspiracy theorist realm around this idea of flying saucers.
Right.
But I'm with you on that. But in the Sumerian language, now I want to make a comment. This is off topic, but on topic. You bring up Sitchin. My research has led me to the conclusion that Sitchin really, he sat down and channeled the materials that we know as his translation.
That could well be. In fact, Timothy Alberino had something like that in his previous film. The Unholy Sea, True Legends of the Unholy Sea, where he was talking to a gentleman who was a friend of the late Zechariah Sitchin, who was talking about how the Vatican believed that there were entities on whatever it was that they thought was incoming, on Planet X, basically. And they wanted to be the first one to plant a flag on Planet X or something to that effect, that the Vatican thought or thinks it knows something about something out there, but they want to be the first ones to claim it so that they can evangelize it before, I don't know, whatever, you know, space missionaries are out there.
Well, at least their motives are
because
pure.
They may be Protestant missionaries that are from Zeta Reticuli. You don't know.
But it's good that they're there because, you know, we need the Vatican to evangelize every possible site on Earth.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. And then to build, you know, buildings on top of the entrances and the portals, which is something else Tim Alberino has researched in his let's talk about that, because let's move this conversation.
We do cover that in the film. We actually
mentioned
that in the
20th century. Right.
We have a whole segment on how part of a segment gets into how the Vatican is always on location where there is some kind of a paranormal hotspot site that's connected to ancient technology or ancient religion. And then what they do is they build churches on those sites so that it looks like it's sanctioned and it's good. They've got good motives about it. It's the Vatican. They just want to evangelize.
Mm-hmm.
And what really is going on is there's a subterranean temple to a false god that is thousands of years old, and they want to have connection to it.
Now, the argument is that they were trying to sanctify what had previously been pagan land. you know, by putting a church on top of it and making it holy ground. I was like, okay, yeah, I guess that's like saying
I'm going to go into the strip club to pass out gospel tracts while there's naked women dancing around. I mean, look, it'll always be a strip club until it gets bulldozed, but these places will always be pagan temples. You're not going to bulldoze them. They are supernaturally protected for the most part.
Well, and that's the thing that I think Tim makes clear in his film, is that the church didn't really seem interested in destroying it, just controlling access to it.
That's what it is. And the access is extremely controlled, to where the people that only make it in are the people that are allowed. And not to mention, this tying some things into the film here, after World War II, okay, Hitler didn't die. We have evidence that he didn't die. Even mainstream news sources and TV programs are documenting it was a body double, didn't even look like him.
Dr. Jerome Corsi, who's an excellent and very careful researcher, very intelligent man, has a book out just within the last 2 years on Hitler surviving World War II.
He survived, and it's very likely that he took off before the war ended. And what happened was, you had Hitler and a whole bunch of other henchmen, we'll just call them, of the Nazi Party. And we break down how it didn't just start after the war. A lot of people say, well, after the war, Nazis disappeared. Now, that is kind of true. That is true, but it's not fully true. The full truth is, from the time, knowing that the war was about to start, so we got pre-World War II, we have during World War II, and then we have post-World War II exile. What we have here is a Nazi exodus, a massive exodus of Nazis working their way from Nazi Germany down to Antarctica, what they'll call the Arctic Plateau.
Yeah, the Antarctic.
So today we say Antarctica, but we're dealing with a region at that time was called the Arctic Plateau. It still is, but that's generally what you're going to find in your research, is the landmass that was really sought after was the plateau, the Arctic Plateau.
Okay.
So, but we call the whole continent Antarctica, but in reality, the Arctic Plateau was a major, major place. And what we find out, and we break down in the film, is it was also a battlefield with UFOs, with technology. If we have time, we can get into that. But the Nazis had this giant exodus. They head down to Argentina. Many records show Argentina as being a stop-off. Now, here's what's interesting. Timothy breaks down the connections between the Vatican and the Shinkana, which they did a great job breaking down the Shinkana in The Unholy See. But he goes into a whole other element of the Shinkana in Hollow Earth Chronicles about how it was a passageway possibly connecting to Antarctica. I said that very well. Antarctica. Yeah. Arctica. Now, I always say Antarctica. But the connection between the two, and this is interesting because the Nazis believed that their birthright, again, this is racism, because it's getting into bloodlines. When you put a bloodline over anything, Paul says there's no Jew, there's no Gentile. You're in Jesus Christ or you're not.
Right.
So as Christians, we know that. But the Nazis believed there was a birthright involved, that they were a watered-down race of what was called the Aryan super race, going back to the days before the flood. And, you know, there's a book called The Coming Race by Edward Bulwer Lytton.
Yeah.
And that basically, even though it was written as a fictional story, it was taken as so much more to the occultists of its day. There were occultists all over the world who took this to be true occult magic. And they harnessed it. They took it. They promoted it. They literally trained people up in what they called harnessing the power of the Vril. Now, anyway, the bloodline thing is interesting, because based on their bloodline, the Germans believed they were a watered-down descendancy of the Vril Yah, being this race underneath the earth that harnessed the power called the Vril. So the race was called the Vril Yah. They were entities. They were Aryan entities, what some people might call alien entities, but they were not aliens, okay? They were demonic hybrids or fallen angels directly. It's hard to say, but it's got to be somewhere in that demonic, you know, field of action, but they believe, because of their relation to these entities, that they had these, they'd inherited this almost like a royal priesthood, right? It's kind of like going an opposite version of what we have in Christ. They've inherited this royal priesthood that gives them access to the inner earth world. So they have rights to the inner earth just because they think that they're descendants of an alien bloodline that lives inside the earth. And they say in their doctrine that the tunnel systems throughout the whole cavernous earth, they could go from pole to pole. And the way it's described, it's almost as if there are portals down there for them to be able to go from pole to pole in such a fast time. How do you go from the North Pole to the South Pole in a moment of time? I don't get it. And this also,
you know, the lyrics to the song, the 1980s song, The Safety Dance, was you know, just coming to my head. They're doing it from pole to pole. Like, okay, all right. It's random pop culture references that pop through my head that at the most,
it's okay,
inappropriate time. Yeah. So I apologize for that. But it is astonishing to me, and again, and this is why I said this at the beginning, that this sounds crazy to people who aren't familiar with the influence that this had on the world. I mean, the guy who wrote The Coming Race, Edward Bulwer Lytton,
yes,
is most famously known as the guy who wrote the infamous worst opening line to a novel ever, "'Twas a dark and stormy night." There is an annual contest.
What else was it?
Called the Bulwer Lytton contest, for people to, you know, to submit the worst opening lines that they can think of for a novel. And that's what Bulwer Lytton is known for to most people. But they don't recognize this science fiction novel that he wrote actually became a religion that spawned the Thule Society, which and then the inner core, the elite within the Thule Society, the Vril Society. And that was the core of the group that made up the Nazi Party of Hitler's Germany.
And it was all a Hollow Earth cult, okay?
Yes.
This was not a space alien cult. Granted, there were aspects of what they would call galaxies, okay? We have a galaxy showing up towards the end of World War II. They talk to this entity they claim is going to get them a passageway into what's called the Aldebaran Society. I'm sorry, the Aldebaran Galaxy. But the reality of it is, it seems to me that that would be just a name, fancy name that was drum up over a portal breach, possibly, to enter into another dimension.
Hmm.
Now, Maria Orsic, this is where it gets interesting, Derek. Maria Orsic was one of the Vril Maidens. Now, the Vril Maidens, that is a group of women who had long hair, and they all had long hair. They were all beautiful. Like, they were well, at least the ones that I've seen pictures of, they're gorgeous women, like supermodels of their day, hair down to their ankles in many cases.
Hmm.
And they were the ones who held the seances inside the Vril Society. They held those seances. Ectoplasmic bursts. That's how it's explained. These secretions, or this ectoplasm would literally come out of them. Now, we live in a culture where you hear ectoplasm and you think of the Ghostbusters,
right,
kind of comical,
right, yeah, that's
kind
funny.
Of funny.
Uh-huh. Slimer, yeah.
Right, but there are old pictures of ectoplasmic bursts where seances were taking place, and they were taking black and white film images, and it was almost like somebody blew a cloud of smoke. Or have you ever seen the slow motion videos of like ink and water and stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of like that, with an invert filter on it. Like, that's what these ectoplasmic bursts look like. It was like this entity almost coming out of the person, and different parts of their body, not just their mouth and eyes. I mean, there was some weird stuff about it. But anyway, so they're channeling, they're trying to communicate. This is back, we're talking back early on, right? This was like in the early phases.
Mm-hmm.
That's Maria Orsic right
there.
Yeah,
I'm going to hold up this picture here and just blow it up a little bit so folks can see it. This is Maria Orsic.
Now, there's some conspiracy theories surrounding her we can get into if we have time.
You're right. She is model gorgeous.
Yeah, and they all are. They all are. And there's even scantily clad photos of them online.
Well, no one. It's a pretty easy religion to sell when you've got, you know, ladies like this. Yeah.
You got the Playboy bunnies running around.
Exactly.
You know, conjuring demons. Mm. So anyway, the Vril Maidens were involved in this ritual that took place. And this is a very popular ritual. And it goes back before the war got crazy. We're talking back probably around 1919, 1920. It's a little bit of a gray area as the dating, but somewhere in the 1919, 1920 area, from my research, they're trying to communicate with a dead person, a specific dead person, right? Well, instead of communicating with a dead person, they end up communicating with this entity that takes over Maria Orsic's body. And the same Maria Orsic from the photo right there.
Hmm.
She begins to automatic write. Her eyes roll back in her head. She's not in control. And she's writing, and what happened in a course of time is she wrote two documents, basically, like two sets of automatic writings. Now, one of them, keep in mind, she's German.
Mm-hmm.
She's German.
Right.
She's not some, like, scholar, okay? One set of writings that she got done, automatic writing, was a coded Templar. It was a Templar language, a secret language of the Templar, and it was coded. She didn't know what she was writing. Now, a Nazi isn't just going to be skilled in writing some secret coded language of the Knights Templar. It just doesn't happen. It doesn't work like that. And then on the other hand, another set of documents she automatic wrote were ancient Sumerian.
Hmm.
Okay, two languages. They have no collusion.
Yeah.
I mean, and so she puts out these writings, and by the time World War II was over, they finally figured out what they said. They finally figured out how to translate and decode it. And so what they ended up with was the blueprint schematics for what we know as the Nazi bell.
Really? That's where that came from?
That's where it came from.
Huh.
The Deglocka. And Jim Wilhelmsen, who's in the film, he says that it was in their belief system. He's the only person I've talked to that promoted this idea, but he's found in his research that the people involved in this practice, they weren't just building a UFO as a fighter ship. He says it was actually a time machine.
Huh.
Now, granted, there's speculation on different aspects of what the Deglocka was,
sure,
or the bell, whatever people want to call it, but it was a top secret craft. And it basically, this entity that spoke to Maria Orsic told her that if done properly, this craft could actually deliver a select few into this galaxy known as the Aldebaran galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And after the war, here's a conspiracy theory. After the war, Maria Orsic disappears, right? Well, that's not so conspiratorial because so did almost a million other Nazis. I told you guys, there's this exodus that was taking place before, during, and after the war.
Right.
Once, including Hitler and Mangala. Mangala ended up down in South America continuing his practice, which is very interesting there too. So anyway, she disappears. No trace of her. And she's not the only real maiden to disappear. But she disappears. Now, here's where it gets really wild. It was in her heart to fulfill this galactic ritual, if you will, to get into this craft and to jump dimensions and escape to another galaxy.
Hmm.
She had set her heart and her will to do that. We don't know where she ended up, but there are pictures on the internet that it's a woman that looks spitting image of Maria Orsic, but she's hanging out with some guy. They're globetrotters. They're literally running around the globe, living it up, very wealthy, and they are caught on camera all over the place.
Hmm.
And he is a Rockefeller. His name is Supreme. I'm probably saying that wrong, but it's Supreme. It's spelled weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like Supreme, but it's not Supreme. And this is a Rockefeller. And so basically what you've got here is a Rockefeller and a woman who looks like 110% accurate match of Maria Orsic showing up around the globe. So a lot of people think that she went through with this ritual. And in this ritual, she somehow became an immortal of sorts.
Hmm.
And in that, she disappeared. She was able to jump dimensions, escape any punishment that might have come after the war. And in that, she met up with this other guy, and she's been connected with the global elite ever since, and that she's traveling around, living her life, basically like a princess.
Hmm.
So, did you see anything on that? Were you looking up the Rockefeller guy?
Yeah, I'm going to have to do some more digging on that. It wasn't turning up anything there, and to get more in depth in the research or into the searches there, I'd have to, you know, tune out what you were saying, which
conspiratorial. It's very much of a conspiracy theory. Okay.
But I was the other thing I was looking up here while I was, cause I've talked to, Dr. Joseph Farrell a couple of times, and, he has written about the Bell. The SS Brotherhood of the Bell was one of the, books that he's written. And he's also done some, research on, the Nazi connection to the Roswell crash in 1947, which I know friends Guy Malone and Dr. Michael Heiser would agree with, that the Roswell crash was actually some technology that we had appropriated from the Nazis after World War II, and with the help of some of the paperclip scientists who were smuggled into the country after the war, we were experimenting on either children with progeria or something. You know, or you know, that those are the bodies that were discovered. At least that's the theory of Farrell, and Heiser and Malone would agree. But there was something with the technology there that we, the United States government, considered very important to get our hands on.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Lavenda, whose name we've mentioned to you a couple of times since you've been here, author of the Sinister Forces trilogy, and also the book on the Nazi occult belief system called Unholy Alliance. Lavenda In fact, I asked him in an interview once, would you say it's fair to characterize our relationship with these paperclip scientists after the war as a the sale of the collective soul of the United States of America to Satan in exchange for, and he said, yeah, that's a fair way of putting it, which is interesting because Lavenda is, I think it's fair to characterize him as an occultist. He is an expert on the occult, but he is not a Christian. Now, maybe that's, you know, maybe I'm being a little too harsh in my characterization. And I should say for the record, I like Peter and, you know, I haven't talked to him in a while, but we've always been very friendly to one another as far as I respect his research. It's been very useful. Especially his book called The Dark Lord, which connects Crowley, Lovecraft and the Cthulhu mythos and basically, religions that worship, you know, astronauts, ancient aliens. So,
how do you do research like we do without being interested in the writings of Lovecraft? It's almost one of those things that if you don't understand some of those writings, going to sound crazy, but by understanding those writings and reading some of the Lovecraft works, getting into them, you're going to find a lot of reality in that writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why I like it. I think because I read it and I'm like, wow, this is a person who understood what was going on.
Yeah. The interesting thing, though, is that by all accounts, Lovecraft was an atheist. He did not believe in these entities, really. He just used them as grist for his mill, you know, to write stories. But what Lavenda shows in his book, The Dark Lord, is that things that were showing up in his stories tracked unbelievably closely to rituals that were downloaded to Aleister Crowley by Lamb, that entity right. that looks like an alien gray. And Lovecraft apparently didn't know Crowley. And that's the thing. I mean, because you would assume, well, okay, he was familiar with Crowley and he was just basically cribbing Telema, Crowley's religion, for his some of the stuff that was showing up in his fiction. But Lavenda says, no, there's no evidence whatsoever that H.P. Lovecraft knew who Aleister Crowley was. So, okay, then what? Apparently they were channeling or at least in contact with, whether he knew it or not, probably wouldn't have admitted it, Lovecraft anyway, with the same entity that was feeding Aleister Crowley his religious system. So, you know, that puts a whole nother spin on the fiction of Lovecraft. And Peter Lavenda, I think, has a long time student of Lovecraft and the spiritual, supernatural influences on Lovecraft. There is reason to believe that Peter Lavenda is actually Simon, the author of the Necronomicon that was published in the 70s and is still in print today, still popular. And there are people who swear that you can perform magical rituals by using the Necronomicon. Well, Lovecraft invented the Necronomicon for his fictions. It was the product of the mad Arab, and I can't remember the name of the author, but the Necronomicon shows up in a number of Lovecraft's stories.
And movies. It's got a cult following now, as it's an object that is people want to
it's
acquire
taken
this.
A life of its own, right. And
right.
So somebody fulfilled that desire, and again, published under the pseudonym Simon, and there are reasons to believe, there is evidence to suggest that it is, in fact, Peter Lavenda who did that. He denies it, but, you know, and I asked him once directly. Of course, he denies it. But still, it is intriguing that the work of Lovecraft appears to have inspired a whole generation of ancient astronaut believers, from Eric von Däniken to Giorgio Tsoukalos and everyone in between, that there are these old, the great old ones, Cthulhu, dead but dreaming, you know, lying at the bottom of the ocean, waiting for the stars to align correctly, for the correct rituals to be performed to wake him up. You know, in Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos, we humans were just an accident of nature, and we were at the mercy of an uncaring and pitiless universe that would someday suddenly turn on us, and woe to us when it happened because there's nothing we could do about it. That these great old ones were so horrific and terrifying that even becoming aware of their existence was enough to drive men mad.
Yeah. But he got the idea from somewhere.
He got the idea from somewhere. Right.
And that's the thing that, you have to wonder, because even though right. people would say he's an atheist, okay, or he would be a publicly pronounced atheist.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, spirits, we hear this term familiar spirits often. Well, right. why do people think they're called familiar spirits? They are familiar with those that they are surrounding. And I believe just like we have angels that, the Lord sends out to do bidding for us and to protect us, and even as messengers, the Bible says, we also have familiar spirits that the enemy sends out to come after us. And our familiar spirits know what we eat. They know our mail. They know what's going on. They know what we're, our strong points, our weak points. That's how temptation gets so hard in the spiritual battle sometimes.
Right, right.
I mean, it's not like temptation just finds us by chance.
No, they know people us better than we know ourselves.
Exactly. Yeah. And we're dealing with ancient entities here. And so somebody like Lovecraft, let's just say Lovecraft, for example, really believed he was an atheist. I'm just saying, just for the sake of the argument.
Mm-hmm.
Familiar spirits, people aren't going to recognize him as spirits if they don't believe in that kind of stuff.
Right.
So you're getting these thoughts, you're getting these creative notions and these crazy ideas. But you're an atheist, so you don't know how to explain it as what it is, so you just write books with your creativity. It's all influence.
This is just my chemistry. You know, this is what evolution has programmed me to do.
There it is.
And else, because it's evolution and I'm programmed to do this, I'm not really responsible for these things that I do that are, you know, crazy.
And that's why every good and perfect gift that, we get comes from above, right? James
right.
talks
right.
about every good and perfect gift comes from the Lord. And as Christians, we don't just attribute things to chance or to creativity.
Yeah, yeah.
See, but you see, the world that doesn't believe in God, the unbelieving world in general, even
they ascribe it to the other. And that's the interesting thing that that dawned on me as we've been talking over the weekend. And I'll say again that Justin's been very gracious here, and we've this is say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We did about seven interviews here over the last 2 days, and you know my mind would be oatmeal by this point. So thankfully we've been tag teaming in and out, and you're still standing, which is amazing. But it occurred to me that. As you were basically implying here, every good gift comes from above. And that's why we're told to look up for our redemption draweth nigh.
Yep.
But here, the Hollow Earth Chronicles showing how for at least 5 millennia, and we don't know going back any further than that because that's about when writing was invented in ancient
right.
Sumer, about 3000
yep.
BC. But for at least 5 millennia, the pagan world has been looking below as the source of all their gifts.
Yes.
Because the Apkallu, the Watchers, okay, the Watchers descended on Mount Hermon, yeah, but the Mesopotamians who preceded Moses believed that they came out of the abyss. They came out of the Apsu. And when their Babylonian chief god Marduk decided he got mad, he banished them to the Apsu, sent them to the abyss. Well, that's what God did with the Watchers. And of course, the Greeks said, well, no, that was what Zeus did to the Titans, sent
right.
them down to Tartarus. Again, it's a lie. Same story, just a different perspective on it. Because the Sumerians and the Akkadians and the Babylonians believed that their chief, you know, the god of the Apsu, Enki, was the only one of their pantheon who was always friendly to humans. The other gods, Enlil, the sky god, Ishkur or Adad, the storm god, you know, sometimes he'd bring the life-giving rain, sometimes he'd smite your flock with the lightning, you know, or blow them away with a windstorm. Ishtar, Inanna, the goddess of sex and war. Sometimes she could be really friendly to you, but woe to the guy who she falls for because he winds up getting, you know, turned into an animal or killed or something. It was weird. I mean, that was how it was. But Enki, the god of the abyss, he's the one who gave us the gifts of civilization. He's the one. And they all came out of the Hollow Earth.
What if, Derek? What if, and this is a what if I want people to think about, everyone who's listening to this show right now, what if the alien deception, what if the UFOs are coming up from inside the Earth?
Mm-hmm.
See, I've got a lot of the research I've done on alien abductions has led me to people being taken into a ship or some kind of a craft and then taken into a cave down into a subterranean realm.
It's possible.
Not up to outer space. Now, mm-hmm. we see them flying around.
Mm-hmm.
But does that mean that's their origin point as of modern society?
Yeah.
I mean, granted, at some point, all the fallen fell. That's what they're called, the fallen. They fell. They're no longer residents of what we would call heaven.
Yeah.
So technically, the earth is the realm of the fallen. The world is a fallen world. Sin has entered in. You've got this world run by an entity that we call Hasatan, or we would just say a team known as the adversary, team adversary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you've got these enemies of God, these angelic enemies of God who fell. They're no longer inhabitants of heaven. Now, I don't know how far up they can go now. I don't know all the details. We can speculate on that. But what we do know is that for millennia, as you've said, they've been coming up from downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
They've been coming up from this hollow earth. And hollow is really a name that we use that term because that's what the New Agers call it.
Mm-hmm.
The New Agers call it a hollow earth, like a big fat shell. And it's so much more than a hollow earth. We're dealing with extra dimensional. We're dealing with subterranean, antediluvian civilizations. We're dealing with civilizations of modern day living giants, Nephilim inside the earth, hybrids inside the earth, entities that are chained up, that are going to be released during the tribulation. We've got entities right. that are not chained up. I believe there are things cooking up right now. Things are being cooked up in the bottomless pit, I believe, for that great and terrible day of the Lord. So, and when we talk about the day of the Lord, I'm sorry, some eschatology people are going to get on to me. I don't believe the day of the Lord is a 24-hour period. I believe the day of the Lord is an umbrella of events.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. Because we're told once those things come out of the pit, they're going to give... They're going to be given power to torment mankind for, what, 5 months, right?
It's crazy.
So, yeah, it's going to be a really, really long day.
But you said something earlier, Derek. There's prophecy. The Bible has prophecy of an Antichrist. But let's talk real briefly about ancient mystic prophecies, going back to Tibet, going back to some forms of Buddhism. There are prophecies that have been foretold that there's coming a day where wickedness is going to culminate on the earth. Keep in mind, this is not from a Christian perspective. This is the New Age perspective.
Right.
Wickedness is going to get so bad on earth that the king of Shambhala, the king of inner earth, is going to rise up to the surface where we live, and he's going to come with his army of entities from inner earth, and they are going to rid the world of evil. And in that action, they are then going to set up a kingdom on the earth and bring about a new golden age. Now, I'm kind of giving a little bit of a teaser of the second film of the series, because we have, this is a two-film series.
Okay.
This is episode one. Episode two, we've already got some of it shot, but we still have a lot to work on. You know, we haven't even finished part one fully.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple little tidbits we're working on, and I don't know when you're going to air this, so if you have to cut that out, that's cool. But, episode two, we're going to get into the prophecies more, and we're going to get into more of how that's tying into end times Bible prophecy. But this is important because we are seeing, as you made a great point, our redemption comes from above.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking for redemption below. Hitler was looking for redemption from below. And the hollow earth is loaded with entities and monsters and deceptions.
Yeah. And it goes from Genesis 1-2, where the spirit of God was hovering over the face of the deep. Well, hovering over the face of the waters, but was basically, it appears to me, containing something there. And I don't think it's a coincidence that in Revelation 13, the beast emerges from the sea.
The sea will give up her dead.
The sea will give up her dead. And then in Revelation 21:1, just before the appearance of the New Jerusalem, we're told the sea was no more. Coincidence?
And also everything on the earth, in the earth and under the earth,
right,
will give glory to the Son of God, Jesus Christ.
That's no better place to end than right there. We should point out that in the film you will see Steve Quayle, Tom Horn, L.A. Marzulli, of course, Justin, Timothy Albarino, as we've already mentioned, Jim Wilhelmsen, you mentioned, Josh Peck is in there. I get a cameo. The topic, again, sounds on its face, if you're not familiar with the concept and how it's influenced the history of the world, to be really, really fringe to the point of crazy. Why are Christians even talking about this? Until you really dig into and look beyond, look at the Bible beyond just a surface level. I mean,
how about read your Bible for starters?
Well, read that. Yeah, for starters, but dig a little bit in there and understand that the sea and the abyss and Tartarus, which is mentioned in 2 Peter, are important. And there are roles to play yet in history. There is a key to the abyss that will be used at one point. the Greek god Apollo, who was known to the Canaanites and to the other Semitic-speaking members of the Semitic-speaking world as Reshef, who's mentioned in Habakkuk 3 and a few other places in the Bible, surprisingly. Although we translate it into just a noun, you know, pestilence. Yeah, okay, but the Canaanites knew, and I'm betting that the prophets knew, that this was the name of a deity, a fallen angel or a demon perhaps, who at least in Habakkuk was serving at the pleasure of Yahweh, doing his bidding. Does that mean that Apollyon, Abaddon, is actually going to be doing God's bidding when he's unlocking the abyss and letting out the watchers, the Apkallu? Yeah, I need to do more study on that. I don't know. But something's down there, and the Bible tells us it's going to be let out. Just pray accept Jesus Christ, first of all, because yes. Then you don't need to pray that you be here during that time, because you won't be, because we are not appointed for wrath. The day of the Lord is when he pours out his wrath on an unbelieving world. And if you've put your faith in Jesus Christ, you're not going to be part of that.
Yeah, that's what you're being saved from. People always exactly. Use the word you're saved. Well, what does that mean? What are you being saved from? That implies that there's something you're being saved from, and you're being saved from God's wrath.
You're not being saved from a life of poverty necessarily. You're not being saved from health issues. You're not being saved from family trouble.
Demonic attacks.
You're not being saved from that either. I mean, you can still be oppressed by demons.
And
you are being saved from the wrath of God when he brings justice, ultimate justice to a wicked world.
And look at the apostles who did mighty works, mighty exploits in the name of Jesus. They suffered types of tribulation and persecution on this earth, and that was not from God.
Mm-hmm.
As Christians, even right now, we may suffer some persecution, and what some might, you know, you got to be careful using the word tribulation, because what we struggle with nowadays is not to the degree they struggled with back then. If people are listening to this in America right now, the American church has no idea what tribulation really is.
No.
I mean no disrespect when I say that, but we have to understand that the enemy will always try to attack us constantly. Mm-hmm.
But there have been parts of the world where Christians have been tribulated since the second century.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
So I just want to say this. You know, we're never appointed unto God's wrath as believers in Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
But we are going to be subject to, let's just say, the wrath of the losing team.
Jesus said we would endure tribulation on his behalf. So,
that's right.
But
greater is he who is in us
than he who is in the world. Amen.
Yeah.
Hollow Earth Chronicles, Episode 1, The Dark Chambers. I'll put it over here to make sure it's actually in the shot. And see, this is a new thing with the webcam over there on the tripod. Justin Fall is the writer, producer, director, and again, film features Steve Quayle, Tom Horn, Ellie Marzulli, Timothy Alberino, Josh Peck, Jim Wilhelmson, and just a little bit of Derek Gilbert. And the film will be out August 1?
August 1st is our official Skywatch release.
When is the what's the website for the film?
The website for the film is fourthwatchfilms.com. It's all spelled out.
Okay. So F-O-U-R-T-H.
T-H.
Okay.
And fourthwatchfilms.com, it'll be available for purchase through fourthwatchfilms.com on pre-order, and it will also be available for purchase through Skywatch. Mm-hmm. You guys are going to be putting together a package on it, some kind of a package. I still don't know what, but it's going to be good. I guarantee you that. And as of now, that's going to be the two main distributing points that we're going to be using. We want to try to keep it limited. We don't want to have it everywhere right now. We want to try to get it between us two. So.
Okay, cool. Well, we'll look for that August 1st, and watch for Justin on a couple of episodes of Skywatch TV coming up in late July, early August. I checked the dates on that. You'll also see Justin featured on Sci Friday, probably before you even have heard this. So you can go back and check that in the Sci Friday archives, youtube.com/Sci Friday. Also, Into the Multiverse, Josh Peck, except without Josh Peck. Josh is dealing with his fourth winter cold of 2017.
He's a faker. He's not sick.
Aiming for a new record. He's trying to get out of having to carry boxes when they move into their new house.
He just doesn't want to be on camera with me. That's what it is.
Justin, it's been a pleasure. We really enjoyed it and look forward to seeing the finished product.
Thanks, Derek. Appreciate you. Yeah.
Check the links in the show notes at vftb.net, or if you're watching this at youtube.com/Derek Gilbert, you'll find a link to Justin's the website for Fourth Watch Radio Network, the Facebook page for the forthcoming film, The Hollow Earth Chronicles, and whatever else I can find to direct you to Justin's work. And again, thank you for listening and watching. It had not been my intention to wait 8 weeks since the last update on A View from the Bunker, the last program. I didn't plan for a two-month hiatus in the program here, and a number of you have emailed asking, is the show over? Well, no, we're still going to do them. It's just things suddenly get very busy. Just about the time I posted the last interview, which was with Pastor Casper McLeod, my book came out, The Great Inception, Satan's Psyops from Eden to Armageddon. And suddenly, I was giving the interviews instead of recording, you know, conducting the interviews. So I've been doing a lot of programs of late. Was on the Jim Baker program, was on Hagman & Hagman, a number of other programs, you know, podcasts and so forth. Now we're doing programs in venues where we normally don't go. Was on the radio in Milwaukee not long ago. This morning was on the radio in suburban Atlanta, a station in Gainesville, Florida, Gainesville, Georgia, excuse me. And that went very well. It was a very brief 10-minute interview, but during morning drive. And so we very much appreciate getting a chance to talk about the subject of The Great Inception on secular radio. But again, that takes a lot of time. And so with that going on, I've not had time to, you know, record interviews for A View from the Bunker. And we got a lot of other things coming up connected to Skywatch TV. Working on a writing project, just turned in two chapters for a book about the Trump presidency, the early months of the Trump presidency that will be published by Defender later this summer. And then Josh Peck and I are working on a secret project, a book that will be out around Christmas time. I think you'll find it intriguing, and I think it'll be a different take on a topic that we've covered quite a bit on Skywatch TV and on View from the Bunker, but we're looking at it from a different angle. And to give you a hint as to what it's about, next week, as I record this on June the 23rd of 2017, next week, Sharon, Josh, and I will be traveling to Roswell, New Mexico, where we will meet up with Dr. Michael Heiser, Guy Malone, Joe Jordan of CE4 Research Group, and some secular speakers, such as Nick Redfern, author of Body Snatchers in the Desert, Final Events, and other books about the UFO phenomenon, Greg Bishop, and hopefully a couple of other guests we're still waiting to hear from, will be there in Roswell for the 70th anniversary of the Roswell UFO crash and attending Guy Malone's conference, Modern Challenges to the ET Hypothesis. He's a brave man, putting on a conference that officially and openly challenges the official mythos of the Roswell UFO crash in Roswell on the 70th anniversary. So hopefully we'll get some other folks as well. So Sharon and I hope to produce a Sci Friday episode. We're planning on it anyway, from Roswell. Just had a thought, something we need to do. Anyway, I got to get this finished up because Josh and I need to start testing out the gear we're planning to carry with us down there to Roswell, video and audio. So we've got a lot of stuff coming up. Then beyond that, there's that, again, the book project that Josh and I will be working on. And meanwhile, I'm working on research for the follow-up book to The Great Inception, digging deeper into the cosmology of the ancient world. And we'll see where all of that leads. This Sunday, June the 25th, this Sunday, Sharon and I will be in we'll be in Joplin, Missouri, along Route 66. Joplin, Missouri, at Southside Apostolic Faith Church. I'll be speaking twice on the subject material of The Great Inception. That will be at 10:45 a.m. and 2 p.m., 10:45 and 2. And if you're anywhere in the vicinity of Joplin, Missouri, and you hear this prior to the services on Sunday, hopefully we can see you there. They'll be recording some video there, or rather the audio of the broadcast. Sharon and I may also try to record the video to make that available later on, but still need to work out those outlines yet, which, again, just an idea of how busy we've been of late. Coming up in August, the Sign in the Heavenlies Redemption Convention. This is the Hear the Watchman Idaho Conference. That'll be in Boise, August 18th through the 22nd. Joining us there, Dr. Michael Lake, L.A. Marzulli, Pastor Paul Begley, Coach Dave Dobenmeyer, and more. This runs Friday through Sunday, but then on Monday, August 21st, we will board a motor coach to watch the total eclipse of the sun from the Continental Divide. Now, I believe that seats on that bus to view the total eclipse is already sold out, but there are still slots open for the conference itself. So if you're anywhere in the northwestern United States in mid-August, we hope that we can see you there. If not, they will have information available soon on the live stream, and we'll let you know about that as soon as we get more information on that. Speaking of live stream, I understand that will be an option also for the True Legends Conference coming to Branson, Missouri, September 15th through the 17th. That's going to be a once-in-a-lifetime conference when you get Steve Quayle, Tom Horn, Ellie Marzulli, Timothy Alberino, Dr. Michael Lake all together in one place. You'll also have the Spanish explorer Anselm P. Rambla, Pastor David Langford, Henry Groover has been added to the speakers list, and if I understand correctly, I will be the warm-up act, in a sense. I'll be one of the speakers at the conference. Again, the True Legends Conference at the Mansion Theater in Branson, Missouri, September 15th through the 17th. Still seats open there, but as I understand it, it is about two-thirds sold out. Dr. Gordon McDonald will be here in the Ozarks in about a week, and we'll talk to him about where things stand and maybe get an update from him for a view from the bunker. It's been so long, I can't even say it. For more information on that conference, gen6conferences.com. That's gen6conferences.com. And then coming up in October, an event that Sharon and I just went down to Oklahoma City to record a couple of programs about, the Blessed Hope Prophecy Forum. That's October 13th through the 15th at the Embassy Suites in Norman, Oklahoma. We had a chance to see the hotel, recorded some video while we were there, and it is going to be a wonderful facility. The Colorado Springs Conference was great, but the one complaint about the Marriott there was that the hallways were narrow, and when you had the book tables on both sides of the hallway, it got a little tight. The Embassy Suite Hotel has hallways about three times wider, so plenty of room to move around, and it's going to be amazing with 33 top-notch speakers, including Gary Stearman, Tom Horn, Ellie Marzulli, Dr. Randall Price, Dr. Tommy Ice, Bill Salas, Rabbi Jonathan Kahn, smartest person I know, Sharon K. Gilbert, Josh Peck will be there as well. I'll be speaking, and this time actually focusing on speaking instead of conducting interviews. Many, many other speakers. Our good friend Carl Chykrib will be there. Dr. Michael Lake will be there as well. Colonel Bob McGinnis. So just a great lineup all the way up and down. You can register for that conference at prophecywatchers.com. Again, the Blessed Hope Prophecy Forum, October 13th through the 15th. And, looks like the Gilbert House Fellowship is going to take another couple of weeks off because we're going to be in Joplin this Sunday. We may try to record the study on Saturday because we don't like missing week after week. The following week, of course, we're going to be in Roswell, so that's going to be difficult. But our weekly Bible study, the archives going back to Genesis 1:1, posted at gilberthouse.org. So I think that's all the housekeeping. But again, just letting you know about the new release now, the new edition of the Great Inception. The Kindle edition is now available at Amazon.com. Oh, there is one other thing I need to tell you about, and that is the Year 70 Tour of Israel. The Gilberts and the Heisers are going to Israel. Yeah, May 6th through 16th of 2018. It's the Year 70 Tour of Israel, and you can join us. This is being coordinated by Lipkin Tours. Aaron Lipkin, son of Avi Lipkin, owns a tour company in Israel, and he coordinates tours like this for ministries and church groups all the time. And they've invited us to lead a tour May 6th through the 16th. They also let us custom design where we wanted to visit, so we will see Mount Hermon, the Golan Heights, which is the ancient kingdom of Og of Bashan, Tel Dan, which is at the foot of Mount Hermon. Of course, we'll see the Grotto of Pan, Benias, the Gates of Hell. We will see Qumran. We will see the Valley of Elath, where David fought Goliath. It's going to be a wonderful tour. We've got about a dozen people already who have indicated that reserved places, let's put it that way. We've got room on the one bus for about 45. We can add a second bus if necessary, but we don't want to make it too crowded of a tour. But again, with about 11 months before the tour, there is time to plan ahead. For more information and to register or at least to reserve your place, check the link in the show notes below the video, or if you're, again, catching this at the View from the Bunker website, vftb.net. So the Year 70 Tour of Israel, we hope to see you there. Just imagine seeing those sites where this divine war took place between the rebel gods and their creator, and getting to pick Mike Heiser's brain. That's worth the price of admission right there. No. We appreciate your reviews at iTunes, Stitcher, wherever else you find us here on the web. And we remind you that View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. The opening announcer, DC Good. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.